together. Together, we are full of belief. Together, we reinforce one another's confidence that we are presentable before God. Together, we keep a firm grip on the divine hope and promise that keeps us going. This divine word that we have received together is something that we can depend on. And let's see how creative we can be, encouraging one another, to loving one another, and to helping others, making sure that we don't miss intentional spiritual times together. For when we do, we short ourselves the dynamic of spurring one another on to love and to goodness. A more traditional translation of that last line says this: let us not forsake assembling ourselves together, but rather let us exhort one another forward. Now, the author of this letter was writing to an audience of people who were facing persecution. We don't know exactly what kind of persecution it was. It could have been that Rome was up to its old shenanigans, trying to corral them back into some kind of political subservience. It could have been that the Jewish leadership was back to its old shenanigan, trying to conform and corral them back into some kind of religious observance, making sure that conformity was there and that these crazy people who were talking this Jesus talk would make sure they did all the legal things they were supposed to do. It hadn't come to bloodshed yet, but that might have only been because there was an interim season, and it might have been that way. It's hard to tell from the letter. And the context of this letter was that the person who was writing to people who, under oppression, had quite naturally begun to lose heart. Some were surrendering to whatever it was that the persecutors wanted. Either they were knuckling under to the political pressure, or they were knuckling under to the religious pressure. And the author is encouraging them to hold strong. He was saying something along the lines of, you have seen something profound and powerful in this Jesus character. You have experienced something that trumps politics and trumps religion, something that was revealed to you that was profound and alive and real and true. And don't surrender this precious reality for the expedience of reprieve. You're at risk, he was saying, of falling back into the dreary simply because it is easier. You're at risk, he was saying, of coming back under the restrictive because it is the norm and it is what everybody is doing, and you're feeling the pressure to come back and conform to the norm. You're at risk of giving up the precious because to have it is demanding. Because to have it is difficult. And so, the author goes on, come on now, you've got to hold on. We saw something in this Jesus guy, we really did. It was something that trumped the mundane. Don't get sucked back into what everybody else is doing. It trumps the ordinary. That shows us how connected we are to God, this Jesus character did. This divine word in us was revealed in him. We saw that it was God's love manifest in each of us and residing among us. And this divine word in us is about the truth of goodness, about life that is beyond life, about truth beyond truth. It is about hope. It is about the capacity to live as an authentic community because we are being transformed into the likeness of God. It's about freedom that is bigger than just merely kicking out the Romans. It's about freedom than justice in our political arena, but it is also about freedom and justice within our own interior worlds. And this thing that we saw, this word that we heard, it's important. It's really important. And you don't want to abandon it simply because things have gotten tough. Now, I know it's been 30 years since Jesus died, and some of you never met the people who were with him during those days. So it is tempting to think of the Jesus truth as something that is far off. and something that is less real, especially now that the powers that be are threatening your very existence. But be strong and hold on. This thing that we experienced, it is worth our very lives. When life, when trouble, when resistance and difficulty threatens to snuff this truth out, he says, we must hold on. And here's how we do it. We hold on by being together. Do this spiritual life, he says, together. Share this spiritual journey, he says, together. Talk about truth and talk about beauty and talk about the things that are stirred within you by the inner voice together. And get creative, he says. Figure out how people encourage one another and do that. Move beyond the platitudes that so often characterize religious life. Move beyond the oughts and the shoulds and the list of things on the wall that we all agree to that makes us us. Move beyond that kind of cookie-cutter conformity and be creative, stirring one another to true life, to true truth. And be creative figuring out how to love one another. Help each other help each other. And help each other help others. Because when you do this, something of a dynamic exists in your heart and awakens in your heart that you could easily have missed. And so don't miss out on the time that is spent together. I know it's hard because when you get together, you risk attack. Because the powers that be know that you're all going to be in one place at one time, and knowing that, that makes it a risky proposition, but I'm telling you, risk it anyway. There is power and transformation when you get together and share your lives in that degree of closeness. Knowing what it might cost you to be together, I nevertheless tell you, do it anyway. It's that important. And that's what was being written 1900 years ago to a group of people who were seeking to live out the same spiritual journey that we are. And it's the same message that resonates with us in our time as well. Authentic spiritual community is that important. Yes, it's tough. Yes, it's challenging. And yes, there are risks associated with it, but it's that important. Do it anyway. Now, every patriotic holiday, one of the cable channels will run a marathon of the Band of Brothers, maybe on the Memorial Day weekend or the 4th of July weekend. And it's 12 or so episodes that dramatize what it was like for one particular company, it's called Easy Company, to go all the way through World War II. It follows them from boot camp, and it takes them through D-Day, and it goes all the way to the end of the war. And the filmmakers reconstruct World War II so vividly that it is often uncomfortable to watch. They recreate the misery and the terribleness so accurately. It's just very demanding to observe it. Because what we end up watching over time is the reality of relationships. People that have relationship one with another. And because of that, we begin to, as voyeurs looking in, feel a sense of connectedness to these young people. And then to watch the snuffing out of these young lives become normalized is awful. Over the episodes, we see this steady attrition happen. Kids that we knew are just not there anymore. They're gone, and life moves on rapidly. And it's very difficult to watch and to see them die so savagely and so violently. It's an awful program. But in the midst of all that horror, it's a beautiful program. Because what you see is you see in the midst of all that horror, something beautiful unfolding. They truly do become a band of brothers, linked by their struggles. The social barriers that would exist such that they would never have the time of day for one another if they all lived in a comfortable place in the States, all that goes away. Because knowing that they will not survive without one another, a bond develops. You stand beside me and I stand beside you. And because of that, I've got a chance to live, and so do you. One episode about the Battle of Bastogne stands out in my mind. Outside for weeks and weeks and weeks in a very snowy winter, huddled together in holes that they carved out of the frozen ground with very few blankets, basically freezing slowly together, huddled together for warmth. And that degree of suffering is sufficient. But then it's punctuated by a regular savage bombing where artillery would come and tear apart their trees and land sometimes on their foxholes. And in that context, the word camaraderie doesn't do justice. The word friendship doesn't do justice. Those words are too limited to describe the trust and the interdependence and the mutual reliance they have with one another. And this is what the author of this letter is getting at. Life is a struggle. Life is suffering. And you are going to need others if you're going to thrive and survive. Life is a struggle. Life is suffering. And you are going to need others if you're going to thrive and survive. Now, when we are not in a foxhole, as most of us are not, when we are not persecuted by the Roman authorities or by the Jewish religious authorities, as we are not, when we live in a consumerist society where somebody goes to work every day thinking about how to make me happy, it's easy to get deluded into thinking that life is not a struggle. But it is. And to believe or act differently is to believe or act at odds with reality as reality is, and we do so at our own peril. Scott Peck wrote an iconic book 20 or 30 years ago called The Road Less Traveled, and it has this sentence that it begins with that has become very famous. And the sentence that he begins with is, "Life is difficult." And the balance of the book is about growing into the thriving, successful environment that we yearn for in the midst of a world where life is difficult. And to thrive in that environment, many would say that the balance of that book is about understanding what love is. If you're going to thrive in a context in which life is difficult, you're going to have to understand something about love. And the author of this ancient letter is saying something similar. You want to thrive? Be together. Learn what it's like to love authentically. Now, this isn't just being together in a watching football or going for coffee kind of way, although that's a very good first step, but it's being together in a spiritually intentional, purposeful way, in an Enneagram group kind of way, or in a life story group kind of way. Be together in a talking about how your soul is kind of way. Be together and share your experience of the interior voice. Talk about your quest for an interior freedom in the area that where you feel bound and you feel trapped. Be together to reinforce your confidence in the ancient truths. Be together to keep a firm grip on hope, to keep a firm grip on promise, to encourage one another forward, to stir one another to experience the fruit of the indwelling Spirit of God. Be together. And without this, in a world where life is difficult, the author is saying, you will get lost. It's just the way human nature is. Just because we are not being bombed and because we are not being persecuted does not mean that we do not live in a world where life is difficult. We do. It is. And without one another, we simply will become casualties. Usually, we become casualties of our own fatigue. We awakened into bodies that have neural networks in our brains that develop habits. And you will follow those habits like ruts for the trail of the ancient prairie schooners, and it will take you all the way to the end of your days doing the same thing you've always done, unless you were bumping up against someone on a regular basis who is helping you jump out of those ruts and go somewhere different. It's just the nature of being a human. You will need to have people around you. You will need to have people who will challenge the way that you think. That is just the way that it is. Without them, you become casualties of distraction. You'll miss out on what matters because you'll be focused so much on what is urgent. Without them, you will become casualties of just the toughness of keeping attentive to what matters. You will be a casualty of turning away from what your heart truly desires in favor of what your heart simply looks for in expedience. Because what your heart truly desires is a struggle. So the ancients tell us what we need. We need a band of brothers. We need a band of sisters who will ask us, how is your soul? And who will insist that we are engaged enough in the spiritual process to have an answer when we are asked. A band of people who go to a discovery dinner together, perhaps, or who are practicing examine together on Wednesday evenings, or forming a new group to practice centering prayer together, or a book club, or a life story group where you tell your spiritual ups and your downs, or an art group where you seek the divine together using artistry. It's a community that is asking one another, how is your soul? And then expecting an honest, unvarnished answer. Expecting a response that says, I have been engaged with that question. I am asking myself how my soul is. And when you ask me, it simply reinforces a journey I am already on. And then having heard one another's answers, we then move toward one another with grace and support and strength and prayer. It's knowing the particularities of attack to which our friends are vulnerable, and then helping head off that vulnerability, being there with encouragement and support and quiet prayers in the night hours. It's digging deeply enough to master the skills that are required to live in this kind of environment, the skills of ongoing growth that we talked about 2 weeks ago. The skill that we called humility, or Bob brought up self-awareness that we talked about last week. And the skill that I want to address today is a tough one to name. I could call it a further manifestation of humility like we talked about last week, but rather than try and name the skill, I'm simply going to tell you a story. And at the end of that story, I'm going to tell you, this has been good for me. Maybe it would be good for you too. In the 1980s, I was in graduate school preparing to be a minister, and though by temperament I'm natural at self-reliance and rugged individualism, I'm good at it, but I learned in my 20s that as a life strategy, this really wouldn't have the legs to take me where I wanted to go, so I had already been working on being intentionally involved in community. But it went to another level when I was in graduate school because at that time, there were a bunch of prominent ministers who were kind of dropping like flies. These guys just could not seem to keep their pants on, or they couldn't keep their hands out of the till. And there was just a series of public scandals that were going on. And the ones that were caught up in public scandals, I already had an impression in my mind that these guys were charlatans anyway. So when they were caught, all it did was just confirm my suspicions. But there were a handful of people that I really did respect. And they got caught in bed with the secretary or embezzling ministry money. And so over a 9-month period, these things happened in rapid succession, and I started to get a little frightened because in the back of my mind, I was able to articulate this idea. If that can happen to these guys that I do respect, what makes me think it won't happen to me? So I went through a time of soul searching and plan making. And it's a convoluted story to tell you to get there. Let me just distill it down and tell you the bottom line. This is where I got. My response, distilled down, is this. Over the years, I have allowed lots and lots of people to challenge me. We know how to put up social barriers to other people, and particularly in religion, we know how to put up barriers that will keep people from going where we don't want them to go. And I've lowered those barriers. I've worked really hard to let people see who I am, and worked really hard to have no secrets, and worked really hard to invite people to comment on what it is that they see when I am transparent. And so consequently, lots and lots and lots and lots of people have lined up through the years to tell me where I'm screwing up. Once I opened up the doors, it seemed like I had tapped into some deep well of pent-up need to straighten out some minister someplace. Because many ministers put out a persona of holiness, or they put out a persona of inaccessibilities, and that you should not touch the Lord's anointed, or some such thing. So when I opened the doors, they really opened, and sincere people, good people, but lots and lots of people, had lots and lots of things to say to me through the years. So along the way, I've had to develop a cluster of skills that are necessary to live in authentic spiritual community, and first, there's a certain level of comfort with being falsely accused. A certain level of comfort with being falsely accused. By Myers-Briggs temperament, I am an ENFJ, and one of my strengths is to get people to like me. I've probably gotten you to like me. Consequently, as a young person who was seeking refuge from my shame monster, there was this strength that I had, and so I grabbed it and I built it into an identity. It's what I do, it's what I know how to do, and I am working it, and everybody does that. This is the way that I did it. So I got people to like me, and consequently, I was able to say, look at me, self. I can get people to like me. I must be okay. Whew. I guess that will help me keep my shame monster at bay for yet one more day. So that's my strategy, and I've decided that I'm going to be open and transparent. Now, it might occur to you, as it has occurred to me over the years, that those two are at odds with one another. That the commitment to lower my defenses against reproof is at odds with the false self strategy of being liked. It has certainly occurred to me through the years that these are at odds with one another, because you open the door to people correcting you and they will curses. We all have this inbuilt know-how. We know how to keep people from poking around where we don't want them poking around. We know how to keep people from seeing what we don't want them to see. If we have a weakness or if we have a vulnerability, we make sure we know how to keep people from getting there where they are aware of it. And so, that's the way our society runs, that's the way we as individuals run, and that's the way the church runs. This being so, we don't often get to see one another's blind spots. When we do, we feel like it's a great discovery. It's not a matter of course on the way that we live. And because we don't get invited into these areas in one another's lives very often, when we get there, we're really not very good at knowing what to do now that we're there. We've become, collectively as a society, pretty unskilled at the art of being invited in to see one another's blind spots and then being able to challenge them when we're there. We work so hard to keep each other out of our private areas that when we do get invited in, we're pretty inept. So when the text tells us to get all up in each other's business, we're just bad at it. And I speak with some authority on this. When I lowered the barriers to reproof, many people came stumbling through the door that I had opened a little bit spastically. Often with more accusation than encouragement, often with more blame than wisdom, often with more scold than invitation to growth, and that was really tough because once that happened, now I have two battles to face. I had to deal with whatever issue was being brought up. And I had to ask myself if it was true. And if it was true, how did I get there? And I had to begin the process of understanding how did that blind spot come to be so that I can understand how to dismantle it. I had to take this to my quiet place and I had to stand before it. I had that battle. But in addition to that battle, I had this one over here, which was my false self reaction, which is I have now got an afflictive emotion because someone has come up and told me something about me that doesn't say, I like you. How could they not like me? This self that I've worked so hard on is nothing if not likable. How could they think I am bad? I've worked so hard to be not bad. And here was the real rub. Sometimes the things that they came blundering through the door to talk about were wrong, or mostly wrong. Oftentimes people would take a snippet of something that I'd said or something that I'd done, and they would wrap it up in a whole bunch of their own past hurt, and they would uncork on me some fight that they really needed to have with somebody else in their life at some other time before they got to me. And that's what I was experiencing. And to be honest, it really pissed me off. There was more than a little bit of righteous indignation, more than a little bit of resentment. This is outrageous, I would say to myself. How dare they, I would say to myself, the injustice of it all. But I've been doing this for a couple of decades now. And over time, I've come to a bigger perspective than I used to have, and this is what I've learned. The false accusations were just as good for me as the times when people corrected me kindly and wisely and discerningly. Because the false accusations gave me an opportunity to have the false self that I had constructed for myself killed off. Now, it's not dead yet, but it's mostly dead. I had crafted a persona for myself that believed I am precious and I am valuable to the degree that people approve of me. I am worthy to the degree that people recognize my worth. I carry the divine image to the degree that people affirm it within me. And that is simply not the case. As I said last week, the starting place for growth is the recognition that when my flaws are revealed, they do not define me. And those few words, when my flaws are revealed, they do not define me, they are easy to say. They're even easy for you to agree with when you hear me say them. You will affirm those words. You think, yes, that sounds right, that's true. But simply because I can say them and simply because you can agree with them does not mean that we have internalized them and we've made them the bedrock from which we live. That's a very different proposition altogether because they are difficult words, difficult to internalize. They only get burned into us by fire. This kind of fire. The kind of fire we talked about last week. The kind of fire where you have to grapple with the afflictive emotion response. You get into authentic community and you do get into fire. And so today I want to forearm you for another very demanding and difficult part of spiritual friendship. And that's this. It's hardest at the beginning. It's hardest at the time when you are just starting to develop a network of spiritual friendships around yourself. It's hardest at the very time when you're most tentative in your commitment to the idea. When you're just now thinking, I might give this a try, that's the time when it's the most difficult. Live in spiritual community and you will get better at spiritual community. It's true. But in the beginning, before you've lived in spiritual community, most of us are pretty bad at the whole affair. We stumble. We hurt each other. We vent our spleens more for our own needs than caring for the needs of one another. We try and fix each other, and we do that so that we can feel good about ourselves, feel like we have something to contribute. We don't give our gifts when they are needed. We give our gifts so that we can feel good about ourselves giving gifts. We're bad at it. This stuff happens, and it happens all the time, especially in the beginning stages, and I will tell you, they are emotionally very, very demanding. So with eyes wide open to that, Here's what the scriptures say. Do it anyway. Let us not forsake gathering ourselves together. It's challenging. It's tough. But so is life. And you need this. So figure it out. Let us learn to exhort one another toward love and toward good deeds. There is something bigger going on here than our need to be comfortable. There is something bigger going on here than our desire for convenience. Because underlying this whole spiritual endeavor, this whole authentic spiritual community endeavor, is something that we really need. And it is the steady killing off of our false self and the steady resurrecting of our true divine center self. And yes, it is painful. And yes, it is uncomfortable. Giving birth always is. But do it anyway, the ancient wisdom says. Get falsely accused. Get hurt. And get beyond it. Over time, you'll learn how to filter the rubbish out and take in the truth. Over time, you'll learn that your worth is not tied to whatever false self-strategy you constructed to make yourself okay. Over time, your friendships will get better at being spiritual together. Over time, more fairness will show up. Over time, more encouragement will show up, and they'll show up more often. It's like anything, you get out of it what you put into it. I've been telling my son for some months now, as we're having our weekly meetings talking about where his life's going, that it's going to take 10,000 hours for you to become really good at anything. And so we started calculating up, what do you want to be good at? How many hours do you have? And we're going to do 10,000. Well, it's going to take 10,000 hours to become really good at doing spiritual community. So we better get started. You'll get better at the relationships if you work at them. And you'll get better at future relationships if you work at the ones you've got right now. But in the meantime, there are things more important than being with people who are already skilled in spiritual relationship. There is something more important that is at stake here than being treated fairly. There is something more important going on here than feeling good. So I guess if I were to sum up the skill that I'm inviting you to today, it is the skill of staying. Find a network of growing people and stay. Find people who are moving with sincere desire to grow and to listen for the interior voice, to seek after the interior divine, who will be faithful in the endeavor. And though they are very imperfect, very unskilled at this, stay. Learn to live in the context of us instead of me. The core team's going back and revisiting our goals as we're trying to make some transitions to make the community more effective for us as we grow. And we go back and we revisit our core values, and sure enough, here they are again. And one of the things that Robin brought up in one of those meetings was this. She said, you know, we really ought to reinforce to our community this. You're going to come here and you're going to get involved, and there's going to be some good things that will happen in your soul. But you need to know that these good sermons that you'll hear, and by the way, you will hear good sermons, the good groups that you get involved in, the good experiences you have, they're good, but they're not transformative. What's transformative is this. 5 years. He said the people who stay engaged for 5 years are the people who transform and change. So we might as well just tell people right up front, this doesn't happen quickly. Get in, get connected, stay engaged, 5 years. So I guess if I were to sum up today's skill, it would be that. It's the skill of staying. And part of the capacity to stay is rooted in how we receive correction. It's rooted in how we handle people's missteps, how we handle people's immaturities, how we are with people who are still growing on the journey. And I would encourage you to stay even when your new spiritual friends get it wrong. Even when they say something that feels more like an accusation than a correction. Because in doing that, you would put justice and fairness in second place, and you would put growth in first place. So I'm finished. However, some parenthetical remarks at the conclusion, an epilogue, if you will. This is one of those lessons that can easily lend itself to misinterpretation. Some people define their false self in terms of self-condemnation. I'm going to beat myself up before anybody else gets the chance. Some people define themselves in terms of what even can be termed self-loathing. And so consequently, hearing a lesson like this is just an affirmation of that falseness. Oh, Doug, you're just saying more of the same. I'm not worth anything, so God wants me to take it on the chin. All right, here we go again. And I hope that's not the case, but I know for some it will be. And if you're in that category, I'm sorry. I would encourage you to put your filter on, not do that. So Spirit of God within us, I pray that you would strengthen us for the journey into authentic spiritual community. Awaken within us the strength and the reserve required to move into this environment with one another, the environment in which we thrive. Be it so, Lord. In Jesus' name, amen.